That's all right. Mine does it all the time. Well, good morning. It's such a great honor to be here and to be able to share with you in this selfie series that Ken started. I really didn't even get the idea of a selfie. I thought it was self-IE until just the other day. And of course, selfie is, of course, taking pictures of yourself and dying to self. I'm teaching a strong class, so I want to do a little recruiting. And we're looking at the subject of what the sermon is today, Blessing or Cursing, You Can Choose, by Derek Prince. We're meeting in 110, the prayer room that's in the second hallway, and come and join us at 9 o'clock or 9:30. The patriarch Jacob had a life of blessings and cursings, just as this series has been demonstrating. Blessings and cursings are an Old Testament principle or theme that is highlighted especially in the book of Deuteronomy. The content is that if you follow God's laws and commandments when you come into the land of promise, and this country that we have is a land of promise, then you will find rest and blessings. But if you choose a lifestyle independent from God, then you will find death and curses. I can argue a case that the people of God, Israel, have never lived in the peace and the rest that they intended to have, as was promised in the book of Deuteronomy, and that the unrest that we find today, even in the Middle East, has its roots in the deceptiveness, the quarreling, the accusation of Jacob and his children, as we're going to look at today. Now, blessings and curses, in a sense, are opposites, and in the book of Proverbs, you often have two opposites that are jammed together, and the principle is that you understand life by how these two opposites interact with each other, and that's very much the issue here in with blessings and curses. For instance, Jacob has a large family, and that is meant to be a blessing. He needs to have 12 children for the 12 tribes, and grew up in a family of just a brother and myself, four of us. And in various times, I was able to live with families that had like 12 or more. And it was always a shock. You know, I mean, a pound of bacon would last 2 weeks in our house. They cook up 2 pounds of bacon in one morning. That's a blessing. But there are also difficulties and quarreling and bickering and within a family that the largest, which is meant to be a blessing, in fact, becomes the curse, as we're going to see in this family that will take over. The original covenant between God and Jacob's grandpa, Abraham, was that it was going to be through the seed of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob that all the peoples on the planet are going to receive a blessing. We see that in Genesis 12, 2 through 3. I will make you a great nation, God says to Abraham. I will bless you and make your name great, so that you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those that bless you, and the ones who curse you, I will curse. And in you, in your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, most of us, and when I first started as a pastor, I had done a lot of work with Abraham. He's the father of faith. And it wasn't until I did a series similar to what Ken is doing right now that I began to notice that, would you believe it, there are more scriptures on the God of Jacob than there are on the God of Abraham. And possibly it's because that in the Old Testament especially, that they admired this man that was going to be the man whom names the tribes that they're a part of. And there's something else too. I think that a lot of people can identify with the struggles that Jacob has, as opposed to Abraham, who seems to be so lofty and so perfect that no one can possibly match him. When I was a seminary student, the pastor of the church that we attended in Richmond, Virginia, took Gwen and I aside one time and said, I want to give you some advice. You're going to tend to want to dwell upon your strengths in your ministry to people. But people can't identify with your strengths because you're so good that nobody can get there. What you will find in ministry is that people will identify with the struggles and the weaknesses that you have in your life because, guess what? Those are the very same things that they are dealing with themselves. And I think that is why in Scripture we have more references to Jacob than we do to his grandfather Abraham. In the series on Jacob's life, let me review what Ken has already covered. It started off with Rebecca finding that she had warfare going on in her tummy. There was a battle taking place in the womb. Two future nations were warring with each other, struggling with each other to gain the upper hand. Esau was born first. But the hand of Jacob was on Esau's heel, trying to pull him out so that he could replace him. And so this Jacob was named the supplanter, the deceiver, the conniver. Isaac favored Esau, and Rebekah favored Jacob. Wow, we already have a recipe for disaster here. Favoritism exacerbates the competition that is going to be between these two sons of Isaac, setting for future curses. Jacob exploits Esau's hunger to gain a double blessing of the birthright. And years later, Rebekah encourages Jacob to deceive Isaac in order to get that blessing. Esau vows to kill his brother. So Jacob flees from his family and his country to save his own neck. And Rebekah is cursed because she will never see her favorite son again. And yet, with all this deception going on, as Jacob is fleeing, the deceiver receives a special blessing from God. Can you figure this out? He ought to be deserving punishment, those of us who read the scriptures and try to diligently follow everything that God commands us. But God gives this deceiver, this conniver, he gives him a blessing, and he sees this ladder going up into heaven, that there is a gateway that he can enter into the center of God, into God's presence. Jacob then flees to Abraham's homeland in Amram to find a wife. But there he has to contend with Uncle Laban, who's a bigger conniver and a bigger deceiver than Jacob is. After 7 years of hard labor with constantly changing his wages and adding new tasks to his job description, Jacob wakes up the morning after his wedding to find that he's in bed not with Rachel, but with Leah, the older sister. Wow, what a switcheroo. But there's an important principle that you need to understand of the law of the harvest. You reap what you sow, you reap after you sow, and you reap more than you sow. Now Jacob's wives and their two handmaidens begin to compete for Jacob's affection by having more children. There's a contention between Laban and his sons as well, because Jacob is gaining ground. His flocks are increasing more than Laban's flocks are. So Jacob is now hurting seven people. His parents hurt two. He's now at seven, and it's going to increase even more. But still, God blesses him. He blesses his family, his flocks. And no matter what Laban does to connive and manipulate, it cannot stop the blessing of God. Jacob is forced to flee. He uses deception, but Laban confronts him. But fortunately, they part in peace. And as soon as Jacob leaves Uncle Laban and that whole issue with the family in the past, he gets the news that his brother Esau is coming to greet him with 400 people, an army. And he's fearful for his life, and so he puts his flocks and his family ahead of him, let them be cannon fodder to his brother. And in the process, he wrestles overnight with God himself. And he doesn't know that it's God, but he refuses to stop until he gets a blessing. Do you see a pattern here? This guy keeps on, no matter the fact that his lifestyle is despicable, he gets all these blessings. And so he demands, give me a blessing or I won't let you go. And his thigh is pulled out of socket. He's wounded for life, but God says, I give you a new name. No longer are you conniver, conceiver, deceiver, supplanter. Your name is now Israel. One who strove with God, a prince in the land, a prince of God. He gets a new name, but he doesn't take the name. He's still Jacob. He goes and he meets his brother. And humbled by his experience with the angel, his brother greets him and they are reconciled. Amazing. And then he decides to go to Bethlehem. And God tells him he's going to bless him again. And on the way to Bethlehem, there's a great tragedy. And this is where we left off 2 weeks ago, if you remember. This is when the last child, the second child of Rachel is born. And in the birth, she dies. She names him Son of Sorrow, but Jacob refuses that name and says, no, this is the son of the right hand of God himself. God's right hand, his strength. Now I was sitting in the pews and just really blessed because I don't know if you know that the tribe of Benjamin were all left-handed. And they're blessed with the right hand of God. That may sound strange to you, but if you put somebody's right hand of God next to a left-handed person, their hands are close to each other. There's a fellowship that they have. And so Benjamin is destined to have a special fellowship like John, who rested on Jesus' bosom. This is the kind of relationship that Benjamin, again, a blessing. But in that blessing, there is the death of Jacob's favorite wife. And he buries her on the way to Bethlehem. And he changes his name to Israel. For about four verses. In fact, he's going to go back and forth 20 times from being Jacob and then being Israel and then being Jacob and going back and forth. In Deuteronomy, it says, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today. This is a sermon of Moses. I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. So choose life in order that you may live and your descendants by loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days that you may live in the land which the Lord has sworn to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to give them. Now, you might say to yourself, this is a no-brainer. I mean, if you got to choose between life and death, what are you going to choose? What? Life. Nobody. Who in their right mind would want to choose death and curses? But just take a moment. How many in your family? How many of your friends? How many of your acquaintances, and maybe yourself, continually choose death, destruction, and curses in relationships in life. A lot of people do. As we move into Thanksgiving and Christmas, there are many people who don't want to be with their family. Their family reminds them of all the mistakes they ever made in the past. Have you ever been to one of those family gatherings? And they bring up all these kinds of stuff from your past that gets you all embarrassed. Now, there are some of you who have great families. This year, for the first time, we're not going up to Pennsylvania to Gwen's family. Her mother died just last year, almost just a year ago. It was on the 9th, I think, of November. And so we're not going up there, but we still maintain wonderful relations. The good blessing to us is we can come to the Thanksgiving party here at the church. We haven't done that for 10, 15 years because we've been going to Pennsylvania every year. Deuteronomy is a series of last words from Moses to the tribes of Israel, and it's proof that the Jacob nature is going to die and that the Israel princely nature is going to prevail. When you get into the land that God has promised you, Moses says, remember my words and my advice, because today is the day that you've got to make a choice. You know, we never make choices in the past. We never make choices in the future. Every choice you ever make is going to be right now, today. That's the fact of life. And so he says, today you need to make a choice. Right here in Hamilton, the people of God here in the new life in your church, make a choice today. And I recommend you to make a choice of life. So make your declaration with me, if you would. I choose life. Let's say this together. Everyone, let's make this a joint declaration. I choose life, not death nor curses. Now, I'd like to say that Jacob became Israel. He lived happily ever after, but this isn't a fairy tale. The change from deceiver to supplanter, conniver to a princely overcomer is going to take about another 30 or 40 years of his life. And he will flip-flop 20 times from being Jacob and Israel in the next couple of chapters. Immediately, Israel is going to find disappointment with the behavior of his own children. Remember, it was the contention with his wives, but now his children are going to take over. The rivalry and competition and accusation of his wives, they're going to be transferred to who? The kids. They learn their lesson real well. This is an outright challenge. Jacob's oldest son sleeps with one of his wives. That's a big no-no. It's an outright challenge to Jacob's leadership and authority. The son is basically saying, I'm going to take over now. Notice that it says Jacob here. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flocks with his brothers while he was still young, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to his father. He snitched on them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons. He didn't learn the lesson with his mom and how that created a problem. Guess what? He perpetuates it. He was the son of his old age, and he made him a multicolored tunic, a robe. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his other brothers, and so they hated him and couldn't speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. The love and the favoritism for Rachel is now transferred to Joseph, and the other brothers resent and hate Joseph. He snitches on the brothers. This makes them even more angry. And in their eyes, Joseph is no longer fit to be a part of the member of their family. Jacob gives Joseph a distinctive multicolored coat. And I believe Joseph flaunts it over his brothers. You think that helps? Jacob is gifted with prophetic dreams, but in his immaturity, he shares what God has given them to people who don't understand it. In his immaturity, he gets even more anger. They feel rejected and intimidated by his gift, and they resent him more and more, and this is going to turn to hostility and destructive actions. And even worse, the dreams reveal that even the parents and the children are going to bow down to who? To Joseph. He will be the superior and will rule over them. Man, that really gets in good with them, doesn't it? And so we read in Genesis, and when they saw him from a distance, because Daddy had sent him, I want you to go with your brothers. I want you to learn how to pasture the flocks. And before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, here comes that dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say, oh, Daddy, a wild beast just came along and devoured him. Then let us see what will become of this dreams. But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, let's not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood, throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay your hands upon him, that he might rescue him out of their hands and restore him himself to his father, and in the process, mainly get the father's favor and get restored back to the first position again that he lost by sleeping with daddy's wives. But they lower Joseph into a pit where he pleads for his life. And he promises not to snitch on them, but the brothers' anger and their hatred drives them on. Then it says, Judah said to his brother, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and to cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay hands on him, for he is, after all, our brother. He is our own flesh. And his brother listened to him, and some Midianite traders passed by, and they pulled him up and lifted Jacob up out of the pit and sold them to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And thus they were the ones that brought Joseph to Egypt. Now that desire to kill Joseph fades, but some of those traders provide an easy way out to just get rid of him. If they can get him out of the family, then everything will be a hunky-dory and right, right? Wrong. So they took Joseph's tunic and they slaughtered a male goat and they dipped the tunic in blood and they sent the multicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, oh, we just found this. Do you happen to know whose this is? Now, how many other multicolored coats are there around there? They knew exactly what they were doing, but they didn't want to lie and deceive. What they wanted Jacob to do was to make the decision that he was killed. It wasn't their fault. They don't have to say it, you see. They don't have to speak lies. They just let Jacob believe that an animal had devoured him. But the end results are not what the brothers wanted. They wanted Jacob's love. And they believed that he would give it to them if Joseph is just removed from the family. But instead, Jacob's spirits die. And he goes into perpetual mourning for 20 plus years. And the bickering and the infighting between the brothers keep on going and gets worse and it gets worse. When Jacob saw the bloody tunic, his spirit died, and he went into mourning for over 20 years. You know, sometimes life hands us some tricky situations. A newspaper photographer was told to go up and take pictures of a fire that was raging in Palos Verdes, south of Los Angeles. His assignment was to rush down to a small airport to board a waiting plane that would be at the end of the strip and to get some pictures of the fire and then be back in time for the afternoon edition of the paper. So he raced to the airport. And he drove his car to the end of the runway. And guess what? There's a plane there with its engines going. And sure enough, he jumps in and they take off. And they get up to 5,000 feet and level out. And he tells them, well, go over there. Let me take some pictures and then fly me back and land the plane. And the guy that's flying the plane says, aren't you the instructor? Uh-oh. I've never landed before. Well, some of us have been in situations like that. Our lives have been going smoothly. We think we're in control. And oops, a little voice. Aren't you the instructor? Things have been going so well for Jacob's sons. They'd almost forgotten about Joseph and all of his silly little dreams. But had they really forgotten about Joseph? Could they forget him? For 20 years, their father had never finished grieving. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Words from Sir Walter Scott that Gwen's grandmother, who lived to be almost 105, would frequently quote. But when they describe an important, describes an important truth that deception, once it's used, requires more and more deception in order for it to continue. Later, we're going to find out that the Jacob's boys say, truly, we're really guilty concerning our brother, because we saw his distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, his distress has now come on us. Reuben answered them and said, didn't I tell you? Do not sin against this boy, but you wouldn't listen. It's all your fault. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. And while they were talking it, they were, of course, in Egypt in front of Joseph, not knowing that he was their brother and that he could understand everything that they were saying because he was in front of an interpreter who wasn't interpreting, and they thought he wouldn't understand. But Joseph turns away and weeps. This is the first time his brothers had expressed their guilt over having sold their brother into slavery and certain death. No. Did they not have to die 1,000 deaths before this one act, for this one act of revenge? Every time they saw their father's grief, every time he mentioned Joseph's death, didn't they die again? And one of the problems with lying is that it destroys our ability to discern truth from falsehood. Joseph wasn't dead. He was just sold into slavery. But the brothers had begun to believe their own lie that he was dead. They didn't know whether he was alive or not. They didn't know that the traders had sold him to Potiphar in Egypt. They didn't know the story about his dreams and how he would come before the Pharaoh and he would be made the second highest person, like the prime minister in Egypt, over all of Egypt. They didn't know all of that. They just knew that they didn't have food and they went to Egypt, and here they were in front of the dreamer, fulfilling the dreams that they had hated as kids. Your servants are but 12 brothers in all, sons of one man in the land of Canaan, master. Behold, the youngest is still with our father today, and one is no longer. That's, of course, Joseph. He accuses them of being spies. He locks them into prison, and then he relents and he gives them what they want. But he tells them, if you come back again, you must bring your brother. Remember, that's the brother of the same mother that he had. You see, God, through Joseph, puts his brothers to a big test. They are to return. they will have to, when they return to Egypt, they will have to bring Benjamin with them in order to free Simeon, who has stayed behind. At first, Jacob refuses to allow Benjamin to leave, but the famine is just too great. Jacob's hand is forced. Benjamin has to go, and he demands that they protect his last son. Have these brothers changed? Do they treat Benjamin with the same scorn and resentment as they had Jacob? Yes, he wants to know those answers. Has there been some repentance and change in their behavior, or have they just remained the same? You know, the famine has stripped away all of the resources. They have only one choice, to follow the dream and to follow the dreamer and to find the hope that they need. Joseph is already ruler over all of Egypt, and he has been made ruler now over his own family, as the dream had said. But will they accept him, and will they accept God? We read, so he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, don't quarrel on the journey. Do you think there's a reason for that? And then they went up to Egypt, and they came to the land of Canaan, to their father Jacob, and they told him, Joseph is alive. Indeed, he's ruler over all the company, over the land of Egypt. And Jacob was stunned, for he did not believe them. And when they told him the words of Joseph, that he had spoken to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him and the others of the family, the spirit of their father Jacob revived, and Israel said, I will go to see my son. There's a change in the brothers' hearts. They're willing to sacrifice their own lives to save the youngest brother. There's fruit of repentance. Joseph can no longer maintain his ruse. He has to disclose his identity to them, that he is their brother. He who is dead has come back to life from the grave to save the family, the nation, and the people of God. Jacob at first can't believe it. Joseph, he's really alive. But Joseph's words and the wagons filled with the riches of Egypt, those are the proof that he needs to bring life to his spirit. And instantly his name is changed from Jacob back to Israel. Again, I'd like to say that he stays Israel for the rest of... That isn't true again. He goes back and forth even more. The dead man comes to life. His spirit is revived. It's enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. So Israel sets out with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba, and he offers sacrifices to the God of his fathers, to Isaac, to Abraham. And God spoke to Israel in dreams and visions of the night. Israel goes back and meets Joseph and the Pharaoh, and lives out his life and then dies. But do you realize that the Hebrew name for Joseph, Yosef, has the same root as Jesus? Yeshua, Yosef are actually interchangeable in the Hebrew. It's like calling me Rick instead of Richard. So in the place of Joseph, it's permissible in Hebrew to substitute the name Jesus. When Jacob heard the words of Jesus, and he saw all the riches of Egypt that Jesus provides, his spirit comes alive. This is an amazing story. When Jesus announced his ministry in Nazareth, he used a passage. I skipped over something. Because the Hebrew root word for Joseph is the same as Jesus, when we read Jesus is alive, Joseph is alive. We're reading that Jesus is alive. Jesus' death on the cross and his resurrection has broken every curse. Hallelujah. Is there something that you're grieving about today? Is there some sin or deception that you are harboring? Maybe for 20 or more years. Jesus is alive. His ministry is to set people free from sin and fear and guilt and the bondages of the soul and spirit. When Jesus announced his ministry in Nazareth, he quotes from Isaiah 61, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has appointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim the liberty to the captives and the freedom to the prisoners, the favorable year of our Lord." And then he closes the scroll and he sits down and he tells them his message. But the scroll goes on, "The day of the vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion and give them a garland instead of ashes, oil of gladness instead of mourning, a mantle of praise instead of a spirit of fainting, and so that they can be called oaks of righteousness, the plantings of the Lord, that he may be glorified." This is the ministry of Jesus to heal and to comfort. Last Saturday, a week ago, Gwen and I were invited to the Beaver Creek Vineyard Church to participate in a special training for PTSD by Dr. Michael Hutchings of Global Awakening Ministry, a ministry of Randy Clark in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. He's developed a 9-step prayer model for people who suffer from PTSD or any kind of trauma, actually, because there are a lot of traumas that many people suffer. We were invited to attend the training, and then we were invited to come and join their prayer team. And I couldn't miss Sunday morning because I had to teach my class here and work at the coffee bar, but I went to the Saturday evening service for veterans and had the blessing of receiving a little coin that they struck that had an angel and soldiers on one side and a quote from Psalm 91 on the other side. And had an opportunity to pray with men who are struggling in their life. We have a prayer team. And if you're struggling in any area of your life, after this service, there will be prayer team members up here. And they will pray with you, and you can be free. One of the principles of this 9-step model is to bring encouraging prophetic words of comfort to show a new direction in people's lives. You see, another way to break a curse is to speak and declare a blessing. Prophetically, we are to go for the gold. We know that phrase with the Olympics, but do you realize there's gold in all of us? But we sometimes have to search for the gold. You know, you can own property that has gold or oil under it, and it is not going to, maybe if you sell it and you can document that it's there, you might benefit from it. But in order to gain the riches of the gold and the oil, what do you have to do? You've got to drill it, you've got to dig it, you've got to get down and get to the gold of the oil and then be able to sell it. We need to find prophetically gold in people's lives and help them to be able to recover that and benefit from that gold. That's one of the prophetic parts of this 9-step trauma program. And our prayer team is also trained to look for gold into your life and to speak those words of encouragement. Find the gold for your life and find the blessings of God. And with them, you can break the curses that have touched you and other people around you. God bless you. Would the prayer team come forward as well as the band as we prepare for the closing hymn, song, and then the hymn following?